Hey, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31, and it is May 10th. We're going to start the respiratory chapter today. And let's see, we have three lectures left. So Monday today, Wednesday, and then Monday next week. Wednesday of next week is finals week, and so there's no class. We don't have a final scheduled for a week from Wednesday. Right, because, and we don't have lecture either, right? But we do have our final on May 24th, which is 2 weeks from today. 2 weeks from today. So I'll try to open up all the remaining assignments in Blackboard so that you can do the rest of the semester. So when you log onto Blackboard, don't get confused what week you should be working on, because there'll be a lot of weeks available for you. So always look at the dates. And the week before, there was a problem with Blackboard, so I'm going to go back and open up the quiz for the previous week. And if you got one of those little notepads in your grades, I'm going to just void your quiz for you so that you can go back and take the quiz. All right, so I'll probably get around to doing that tonight sometime. Okay, I think you're on week 15 right now, which is due tomorrow night, so that would probably be week 14. Okay, so week 14. Yeah, I know it's pretty confusing to remember all that stuff. I can't remember the chapter. Probably, what, vascular chapter maybe? Blood vessels, yeah.
When you open them up, does that mean that we can take 16 or 17 prior to the last week?
Well, would you guys like to do that? Should I just open up all the quizzes and then... Yeah, okay, I'll do that so that way you can... because finals week is starting, what, a week from Wednesday? Yeah, I'll try to open up everything that's required for you so that you can get ahead of schedule. That's fine. But you got to pay close attention to what week you're working on so that you don't miss one that, right, don't go to next week and forget to do this week's is what I'm trying to say. Yes. Open lab. Thanks for reminding me. Yes, open lab. I'm going to be upstairs in that study room tomorrow from about 1 until 4, but it is open almost all day tomorrow, maybe from noon until 5:30. So I'll be there part of the time, but other instructors are scheduled to be there for most of the day tomorrow. Okay. Another question, or was that, yeah? Yeah, same kind of test, just from leaving off at the last test to through reproductive chapter. Oh, the time is going to be a little bit different, I believe. From 10:30 to 12:30, so it starts at the same time. But since it's a final exam, it's 2 hours. So you won't be maybe quite as rushed. It won't have more than 100 questions. It'll be like a regular test. Okay. Fantastic. All right, so respiratory system. You know some of the organs involved with the respiratory system, like the lungs and trachea, nasal cavity, all that kind of stuff. Maybe in lab we didn't talk about the functions of the respiratory system, so let's go over that pretty fast. All right, one function is ventilation, moving air in and out of our lungs. That's basically what we consider breathing. We're going to look at that a little bit. And then another important function is gas exchange between air in the lungs and the blood. So what does that mean? What does the lung have to have in order for exchange to take place?
Capillaries,
exactly. If you thought of that right away, that's fantastic. All right, and then respiration, or the respiratory system, also includes the transport of important gases through our whole body, namely oxygen and CO2. Oxygen is what our bodies need, and when your body uses up oxygen, it produces CO2. So we have to inhale oxygen, we have to exhale CO2 to the environment. All right, and of course, then there is gas exchange between blood and tissue. So you should see basically two circulations right here. All right, what are the two circulations that you should think of when we talk gas exchange? What are the two circulations? The pulmonary circulation and then the systemic circulation. Both of those have to have those things we call capillaries for exchange. All right, so the respiratory system can be broken down into two major categories, the upper and the lower respiratory tract. The upper includes the nostrils. Well, let me pick up a picture right away. Let's see if we can find a picture. Okay. All right, so this kind of shows the whole respiratory tract, right? The upper respiratory tract includes the nose, right? The nasal cavity, the nostrils, all these nasal conchae right here, and then the pharynx. So the pharynx is just the back of your mouth. What's a common name for pharynx that maybe you would use? Your throat, right? So that when you have a sore throat, what do you really have in a more medical terminology? You have, yeah, pharyngitis, right? So sore throat or pharyngitis is the same thing. Okay, so here you see the pharynx, and then right below the pharynx starts the larynx right here, right? That is a part of the airway, and this is where the lower airway starts. So here's like the line of demarcation between the upper respiratory tract and the lower respiratory tract, that's the larynx. Now, people can get infections of the larynx as well. What do we call that? Do we call that a sore throat? That's called laryngitis. And how is that really a lot different than a pharyngitis? You can't speak. You lose your voice because in the larynx right here, you have vocal folds that vibrate back and forth for you to vocalize with. All right? So that's a really easy way to remember the difference between the pharynx and the larynx. All right, the remaining parts of the lower respiratory tract include the trachea, right? And then after it bifurcates right about here as it goes through the mediastinum into these branches that we call bronchi. And this is a primary bronchus, or maybe we would call this a main bronchus. And this, of course, is on the left side of the thoracic cavity. This is the right main bronchus over here. And then when a bronchus bifurcates once again, we're going to call that a secondary bronchus and then a tertiary bronchus until they get smaller and smaller and smaller. All right, notice that the lungs have three lobes on the right and only two lobes on the left. Why is that? Yeah, because the heart takes up space on the left. And here you can see that nice cardiac notch right here. All right, notice that the trachea has cartilage and the larynx has cartilage as well. Okay, and so this airway is open all the time. The trachea, and as a matter of fact, the bronchi are open all the time. The larynx is open all the time. And I think clinically that's really important, and you should kind of be aware of that, because it has to be held open in order to get air in and out of your lungs. Sometimes when you're breathing forcefully, when you're hyperventilating, maybe due to exercise, you have to pressurize your chest to get the air out of your lungs. And when you pressurize your chest, if these airways didn't have cartilage, guess what would happen to them? They would collapse. And then, of course, once they collapse, air can't pass through, and that would be really terrible because in order for you to inhale oxygen, what has to happen to the air that's in your lungs? Well, it's got to leave first, right? And if air can't leave your lungs, there's no way to get new air in there. All right, so that's why all of these structures have cartilage, but there's some jeopardy to that. What's the jeopardy in having these airways open all the time, held open? Infection, maybe, not too big a concern because this is a special epithelium right here that's cleaning itself all the time. Okay, yeah, you can aspirate stuff, or maybe not even aspirate. All you have to do is hold an object right about here in the larynx and let go, and what's going to happen to it, even if you're not breathing? It's going to fall right in here, and then that could occlude that airway, and then you can't breathe. What's it like? Anybody ever not been able to breathe in here? Well, you're miserable, and the bad thing is that you're only miserable for a short period of time, because what's going to happen? Well, you're going to die. Okay? So, there's some jeopardy for having these passageways held open all the time because they can be occluded. And if you can't breathe, you can't talk. So you should all know the universal symbol for choking. What's that universal symbol? Two hands around your neck, so if somebody's CPR certified, they know that you're choking, and then they can do what kind of exercise on you to help open that airway? Yeah, the Heimlich maneuver, okay, which is pretty forceful, and don't ever do that on somebody unless you have their permission or implicit permission, right? So if somebody can ever tell you, no, please don't do that maneuver on me, then don't do it on them, because it's kind of a nasty thing to do if somebody's not expecting that, okay. All right, so those are the major parts of the airway. Let's talk about maybe some of the more specific things. The nasal cartilages, we don't go over very much in here. All right, so here's a nice exam figure. So here you can see the nostril, right, and the vestibule inside your nose. It's made by the nasal cartilages. And you can see the turbinates right here. Okay, one thing that since we just got done talking about the lymphatic system, here are the three sets of tonsils, right, which I didn't have a slide to show you last time. Here are the palatine tonsils. These are in what we call the oropharynx. So these you can see just by looking in a mirror, right? You open your mouth, say, ah, you can see these guys right here. The other sets you can't see. Here are the lingual tonsils right here. Those you can't see. And then here are the pharyngeal tonsils way up here. All right, these are supposed to fight infection, but every once in a while, they become chronically infected to where you have a sore throat maybe every couple weeks. And you might miss work every couple weeks. And, of course, feel miserable when you can't go to work. And if that's the case, then these chronically infected tonsils should be removed. And so you might have a child that has them infected, and it's not such a big deal if it's a child. But if you're like our age right now, an adult, that tonsillectomy is kind of a big deal, kind of a big surgery. It's so much so that you're going to have at least 2 weeks off of work because it leaves a big, kind of massive hole in the back of your throat when you get those tonsils removed, and you won't feel like doing much for a while. So your tonsils are pretty much like as big as the tip of a finger, and if someone were to gouge out that amount of tissue from anywhere on your body, how would that area feel for a while? Really sore, right? And the other thing is you can't suture it closed because then it's going to abscess, so you have to let it heal from the inside out. That takes time, right? But it's well worth it because after you get a tonsillectomy, you might not get a cold or a flu or something like that, sore throat for over a year, right? As opposed to having a couple every month to not being sick for a year, that will certainly change your life for the better. So it's worth doing. Okay. All right, then we just see the oral cavity right here. Here's the opening to the eustachian tube inside the pharynx. Notice that we need to break the pharynx down into three subdivisions. Here's the nasopharynx, just posterior to the nasal cavity. Here's the oropharynx, posterior to the oral cavity. And then the laryngopharynx right here, posterior to the larynx, which is what? The opening to the lower passageway. So the oropharynx and laryngopharynx serves two purposes, passageway for air as well as nutrition, right? And the nutrition should go down the esophagus to your stomach, but air shouldn't go into your stomach. It should go into the trachea right here. Normally, the esophagus is closed unless you're swallowing something. So air usually doesn't have an opportunity to go down to the stomach. But when you swallow something, right, this larynx is open. So something special has to happen to make sure that food goes into the esophagus and not into the trachea. Because what will happen if it goes into the trachea or the larynx? You're going to choke, and hopefully not to death, but that certainly could happen. All right, so there is a trapdoor that covers the opening to the larynx. That opening is what we call the glottis. Here is the trapdoor, right here. When you swallow, this point bends down over the glottis so that food slides off the epiglottis into the esophagus right here. All right, so that's some nice elastic tissue. And you should know something about that epiglottis because it gets lazy on a certain day of the week. So some of you that have had lab already with me kind of know this. All right, but there's a day of the week that it gets lazy, so that means food has a tendency to get stuck in the trachea during that day.
Monday.
Well, that's close. That's really close. But it's usually so, and what? There's also a time during the day where it gets lazy. Okay. And it's usually associated with adult beverage, which is what? Alcohol. Yeah, and intoxicant. So Friday is a prime example, especially during happy hour. Okay, this epiglottis gets lazy because a lot of times you go out with your coworkers, right? And you're having some beer or drinks or whatever, and maybe you're eating some nachos or popcorn shrimp or something. Just as you're swallowing something, somebody tells a joke about your employer, which is really funny. So you try to do what at the same time? Swallow and breathe at the same time, and there goes that popcorn right in here, okay, right into the trachea. So those of you that are CPR certified, right? Around those times, if you're ever in public at a restaurant or at home and a lot of people are horsing around, right, just kind of pay attention to them because, remember, you can't yell for help when you're choking. Probably the next most common time would be Saturday night as well. And it's going to be associated with what?
Alcohol.
Adult beverages, that's right. Okay, alcohol, same thing. All right, so the larynx has some important cartilages. All right, here's the thyroid cartilage. Besides the epiglottis, here's a thyroid cartilage, which is mostly just anterior and laterally, but there is one below the thyroid cartilage that completely encircles the larynx, and that's the cricoid cartilage. Okay. All right, and inside the thyroid cartilage are the vocal folds for vocalization. Okay, what else do we need to know about this? The trachea. Okay. So here's the trachea. Here we can see some cartilage, nice hyaline cartilage. And the epithelium that lines the trachea is that pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium that we see right here. And I can see some of these cells. What are these cells that look kind of clear? Goblet cells. They're secreting mucus onto the apical surface of the trachea. And what else do you see on this apical surface right here? Yeah, I see some cilia right there. So these are sweeping. Guess which way they're sweeping? Up or down?
Down.
Okay. Your lungs are a dead-end compartment, so if anything gets down in there, it just kind of will pile up. And then you won't be able to inflate your lungs. So the cilia are actually sweeping mucus and all the garbage that we're breathing in, like dust particles from your clothes and things like that, gets swept up into your mouth. Okay? And then where does it go once all that garbage is in your mouth? Yeah, laryngopharynx, oral cavity, and then most people just kind of swallow it down, okay? Unless you're a baseball player, then what do you do? Well, that's one way of saying it. You expectorate, okay? If you're a baseball player, then you expectorate all the time, okay? All right, so that's one disadvantage of having the lower airways open all the time. The posterior part, there is a muscle right here called the trachealis, and then immediately posterior to the trachea is the esophagus, and there's no cartilage on this posterior aspect of the trachea because when you swallow a bolus of food, right, it wouldn't be able to pass if there was a hard barrier right here, right? So the trachealis muscle just helps allow that bolus of food to pass by. And can you recognize this hyaline cartilage over here? Hopefully, maybe you can see that this is cartilage. Okay. Okay, the bronchi. Right, the trachea bifurcates into the bronchi left and right, and then the main bronchus will bifurcate into smaller and smaller bronchi. All right, and then finally we get down to some microscopic structures that we call bronchioles. Right, and if a bronchiole is in this respiratory zone right here, these bronchioles do not have cartilage associated with them. And they start to be populated with some capillaries. All right, so where can gas exchange in the airway begin to take place? In a respiratory bronchiole, because there are some capillaries. And then the respiratory bronchioles open into alveolar ducts, which maybe still have some capillaries. And then there's going to be a group of alveoli called an alveolar sac, and then finally, air is going to enter an alveolus. That's singular for alveoli, right? That's a special pocket for gas exchange. So what does all this kind of look like? Okay. So here we see a terminal bronchiole. There's no capillary on them, but here are some respiratory bronchioles, and you can even see some of these little pockets on respiratory bronchioles. This is where gas exchange starts to take place. And then there are small ducts between these pockets of alveoli right here that we call sacs. And an alveolar sac is made up of numerous alveoli. So now these are extremely microscopic. And there are even pores between various alveoli. And you have about 300 million alveoli in your lungs, in both of your lungs. These alveoli are surrounded by a capillary network right here. So these are very efficient machines for exchange. The other thing that I see on this alveolus are these blue fibers right here. These are elastic fibers. So that when you inhale, an alveolus is going to expand, right? And the muscle most responsible for that is the diaphragm. And when you relax the diaphragm, air is going to flow out of your lungs because guess what these elastic fibers do? Yeah, will help push it out of your lungs, right? If you have normal lung tissue. Okay. Some people lose these elastic fibers, so guess what they have trouble doing? Exhaling. And that doesn't sound like such a big deal, but before you can inhale, what has to happen? You got to be able to exhale first. So those people actually are in quite a bit of trouble when it comes to ventilation, right, if they can't exhale. All right, so we got 300 million of these like little grapes right there, and I want you to know a basic concept we're going to talk about in terms of the digestive system as well, and that is surface area. How would you calculate surface area? What's the surface area of this piece of paper right here? We would multiply what? The width by the height, which is 8.5 inches by 11 inches. If you got a calculator, I can never remember that number. Multiply those two numbers together, and that's the surface area of this piece of paper right here, which is pretty big. That's almost as big as my chest, right? But I want to tell you what the surface area for exchange is in the lungs. So let's do this. I don't think we've done this in here yet. Let's calculate the surface area of this door. What's the surface area of this door? I've got a meter stick right here. Yeah, here's a meter stick. So what is the surface area of this door? It is? How wide is it? Can you see? It is? In terms of meter? It's 1 meter wide. Okay, and let's look at how tall it is. All right, here is 1 meter, and then here is exactly 2 meters. Okay, so what's the surface area of this door? It is what? 1 times 2, or 2 square meters. All right, so, what is this thing again? It's a doorway. So that means it can allow people to enter a room. How many people can get through this doorway at one time? Two, maybe three, something like that. Right, 2 people for 2 square meters. That's like 1 square meter per person. Now, let's just say we don't have a pedestrian door, but we have a door that's on your garage for your cars. How many people can go through a car doorway at one time? 20 maybe, something like that, at least 10. So as the size of the doorway goes up, what can you tell me about the number of people that can go through it? It increases. We say that's directly related. As the doorway increases, what? Exchange increases as well. All right, so the bigger the doorway, more exchange can take place. All right, so let's get back to the lung and talk about surface area. And when I say surface area, what should you the functional sense? What is the word that you should really be thinking about when I say surface area? Say doorway. Surface area and doorway for exchange, right? And as the doorway increases, exchange is going to increase. All right, so let's take an alveolus. And let's kind of peel it like a grape. And then we lay it flat on a piece on a table right here. But not just one of them. How about all 300 million of them? Lay them flat on a table, all right, which is the surface area. But what is that really? If we lay all those alveoli flat, flatten them out, it's just a flat surface area or doorway for exchange. And if we were to measure it, it would be 70 square meters. Now, how big is 70 square meters? That's about half of a tennis court. That's the doorway for exchange in our lungs, half the size of a tennis court. And evolution has figured out a way to take that huge surface area, fold it up, and stick it in our lungs, and that's the doorway for exchange for oxygen entering our body and CO2 leaving. So I think that's a pretty nifty feature of our lungs. Right, all of that folding that's taking place, because I can't imagine why I would want to be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall just to have my lungs there, right, if it was just a flat sheet. All right, so that's pretty cool. That's the surface area. All right, well, let's look a little bit more detail at an alveolus. Let's really zoom in to an alveolus. So here's a little pocket right here. And there's a special kind of epithelium. Oh, I tell you what. What are the four main kinds of tissues in your body? Epithelium's one. Connective tissue's another. Muscle tissue and nervous tissue. Those are the four kinds, right? And an epithelium is something that lines a cavity or covers a surface. So here we have an epithelium that is lining this alveolus right here. And what kind of epithelium is specialized for exchange? Is it going to be a thick one, like a stratified, or should it be a thin one? Thin. How do we talk about the thinnest kind of membrane? The thinnest kind of epithelium is? Simple. Okay? And should it be columnar?
No.
It should be? Flat. Squamous, right? So simple squamous epithelium will optimize for exchange. So that's what we see right here. All of these are simple squamous cells. And the cells that make a capillary right here, the endothelium on a capillary, of course, are what? Those are simple, that's a simple squamous epithelium as well. So oxygen can move and carbon dioxide can move back and forth across this, what we call the respiratory membrane, very easily because these are just simple squamous epithelia, which are very, very thin. All right, so here we have an alveolar type 1 cell. This is what makes the alveolus up, but there are other kinds of cells in the alveolus as well. And it's the alveolar type 2 cell that I see here, here, and here. Okay, and they secrete something special. All right, now what about water? What do you know about water? Is it slippery or sticky? Okay, if it's on the floor, you got to watch that you don't slip. But have you ever had, maybe you're doing dishes and you put a plate on the counter and you washed another dish and they were still wet and you put two dishes on top of each other? All right, and they get stuck together. Unless you slide them apart. It's almost impossible to pull them apart like that because water molecules really do like to stick together. And as a matter of fact, maybe some of you have been hiking out in nature someplace, in a little pond or water, and you can even see certain animals like walk right on the surface of water. What kind of animals am I talking about? Like insects, like water spiders and things like that, because they're not heavy enough to push the water molecules apart, because water molecules like to stick together. Okay. So that's what would happen to the lung right here. This side of the alveolus would touch this side over here, and then it would get glued together, and then you couldn't inflate that alveolus again and breathe. We call that surface tension. And so these type 2 cells secrete something that's like a soap or a detergent called surfactant. And that breaks surface tension and it allows the alveolus to expand. All right, and so these cells are one of the last to develop during gestation and they don't start secreting surfactant until the fetus experiences some kind of stress. And then they start secreting surfactant and then the lungs of that newborn baby can inflate. All right, so what's a normal stressful circumstance that a fetus undergoes, right, that helps the release of surfactant from these alveolar type 2 cells? Yeah, just the process of being born is very stressful. And that's the signal to turn these cells on, right? But if an infant is born by cesarean section, maybe prematurely, then these cells the infant doesn't experience the same kind of stress. These type 2 cells are not mature enough. All right, and that infant has respiratory distress because of the way it was delivered and the term, right? There was a short-term gestation. And what do we do for infants that are in respiratory distress, maybe due to that? Yeah, we put them in an incubator and increase the oxygen content so that helps overcome, right, the deficit of their pulmonary function. All right, so that's an important thing that you should know about these alveolar type 2 cells right here. Allows your lungs to inflate. And under certain circumstances, even in the adult, maybe these cells stop functioning. In which case, right, then we have to treat them with increased oxygen for them to breathe. Okay. Oh, there's also some macrophages in there. Where is that at? Macrophages. Do I see a macrophage? Here's a macrophage here and here. These are white blood cells that have left the bloodstream, and their job is to fight infection. And these are shapeshifters, so they can easily crawl around in between cells looking for things that don't belong, and they destroy cells by phagocytosis. They eat particles, and then they break those particles up. They digest them, and that helps fight infection in your lungs. All right, so that's all of the cells. All right, here's the respiratory membrane. Okay, what makes up the respiratory membrane? There's something that's not on this slide that actually I would like for you to know, but I think you might have a question, an online question that doesn't mention it. So just kind of be aware that the online question doesn't follow my discussion here. Let's start with the blood. All right, so what's the first area, barrier for CO2 leaving the blood to get into the alveolus? It's the wall of the capillary right here, the endothelial wall. That's the first part. Then we have a little interstitial space, a basement membrane, and then we have the wall of the alveolus right here. So most people consider that the respiratory membrane that these compounds have to diffuse across. But there's one other component that I don't want you to forget about. There is a layer of chemical right on the surface of the epithelium of an alveolus. What was that chemical that helps the lung inflate? We call that surfactant, right? So here is a layer of surfactant, and of course the gases have to diffuse through that layer as well, but it's microscopically thin, so we couldn't even draw it to scale. All right, so the respiratory membrane has got that layer of surfactant, the wall of the alveolus, the interstitial space, and then the wall of the capillary, but notice how thin they are. So that's a very efficient structure for exchange. All right, well, since we're talking about layers, guess what? Let's talk about some more layers. All right, so the lungs are in a cavity. What kind of cavity are the lungs in? Open to the outside world or not open to the outside world? Not open to the outside world. Yeah, let me expand this just a little bit. Where can I expand it? Right here? All right, so the lungs are not open to the outside world. So what kind of cavity is not open to the outside world? There are two kinds of cavities. One's open to the outside, one's not open. Serous cavity versus a mucus cavity. Like oral cavity, that's a mucus cavity. It's lined by a mucus membrane. But a serous cavity has what? A serous membrane that surrounds it. All right, so as a matter of, so let me zoom in even a little bit more so that you can see these. All right. Now, a serous membrane is a little bit more complicated. How many divisions does a serous membrane have? It actually has three parts. A mucous membrane only has one part. All right, so here's the lungs. So this is what we call the pleural cavity. There is a lining that's right on the body cavity. Right, this is a superficial lining. This is what we call the parietal division or the parietal pleura. Okay, and notice that it's continuous. If we go all the way around here, it's continuous with the membrane that is right on the surface of the lungs. We call that the visceral pleura. Right, so you got parietal pleura, visceral pleura, and then the third part is the space between them, and that's what we call the serous cavity, right, or the pleural cavity, and it's filled with serous fluid. Okay. Now that serous fluid does not have surfactant in it. It just has more of a watery kind of serous fluid. And so what is water? Sticky or not sticky? Sticky. All right, which is a really good thing. So that means that the lungs kind of stick to the wall of the thorax, right, because it has that serous fluid in there. So that when we expand our rib cage, it actually helps inflate the lungs because the lungs are attached to the wall by that serous fluid right here. All right, so that's something important to know about that serous cavity. All right, so it acts to couple or attach the lungs to the thoracic cage. All right, what about breathing, mechanics of breathing? We can break it, that breathing down into two parts. These are what? Inhalation and exhalation, okay, two different parts. And in particular, the way that we breathe can be broken down into two different ways. One way is what you're doing right now, which is what we call quiet breathing. Another kind of breathing is if you were to run up the stairs. What would happen to your respiratory rate if you were to run up the stairs, or maybe even walk up the stairs? It would increase. We call that forced breathing. All right, so there's two different kinds of breathing. All right, let's talk about inspiration first. Inspiration is due to the enlargement of the thoracic cavity. Our thoracic cavity has got to increase, and when that happens, the pressure inside our lungs decreases. It goes below atmospheric pressure. And which way does a fluid want to flow? Anybody have an idea which way fluid wants to flow? Like even a gas that's in this room. It's going to flow down a pressure gradient. It will always flow from high pressure to low. So that when we expand our rib cage, the pressure decreases, so air just flows in our lungs as a result. All right, so for quiet breathing, the most important muscle for inhalation is the diaphragm. All right, so the diaphragm is dome-shaped, and when you contract the diaphragm, it flattens out and moves inferiorly, just like that, and then air is going to flow into your lungs. All right, let's talk about expiration for quiet breathing. All right, the diaphragm is going to relax, and when it relaxes, guess what happens? It goes back to that dome-shaped structure, and the volume of your thorax decreases, so the pressure increases, that forces air out of your lungs. But what else happens? We force those alveoli to expand by contracting the diaphragm, so the alveoli expanded. But what's around every alveolus? The capillaries. Capillaries have a little elastic property, but there's something that's even much more elastic around every alveolus. Those blue fibers, which are elastic fibers, so an alveolus will shrink down, and that will cause air to leave your lungs. So, for quiet breathing, expiration is passive, meaning it doesn't require any energy to exhale for quiet breathing. The only thing that you need to do to exhale for quiet breathing is just to relax, and air is going to flow out of your lungs, if you have nice, healthy lungs. And I hope you all do. And I hope you all take care of them. Okay, there's one important cause for emphysema. And it's voluntary, at least in the beginning it's voluntary. It's cigarette smoke, really damages lung tissue. And you see how delicate the lungs are, how important it is just to be able to exhale, to have nice elastic structures in your lungs. And there's another kind of smoke that's even more damaging to your lungs. Been the hot topic lately in the news. Maybe marijuana, you're right. So everybody's saying, oh, marijuana, you know, is great. It doesn't cause any problems. Oh, it's hugely dangerous to your lungs in terms of emphysema. Okay? So I wish people would talk about that. Because you won't like your life very much if you lose your pulmonary function or your lung function. Okay? Okay. You'll never be on American Idol, that's for sure. Okay, for forced breathing, let's talk about forced breathing. So now you're exercising, you have to move a lot more air in and out of your lungs. All right, so not only do you use the diaphragm for inspiration, but also the contraction of the pectoralis minor helps elevate the ribs, the external intercostals elevate the ribs, sternocleidomastoid helps elevate the ribs, that increases your thoracic cavity, and even the serratus anterior can elevate the sternum and the ribs. So that's going to be pretty important. So what's going to happen to the ribs when all of these muscles contract? Okay. All right, so here we see for inspiration, the diaphragm decreases, so that's going to help inflate the lungs. But when all those other muscles, like the pectoralis minor, sternocleidomastoid, right, here is, at the start of inspiration, the size of the thoracic cavity, and then at full inspiration, notice that the thoracic cavity has expanded, not just anteriorly, but laterally as well, all right? So think of this as like being a bucket handle right here. So if you lift up a bucket handle, it expands the ribs laterally, and it pulls the sternum up, and inhalation will take place. Okay, now for forced expiration, right? When you're hyperventilating, how do we get more air out of our lungs more quickly? We can't just relax. That won't happen. There has to be contractions of some muscles, like the internal intercostals. All right, so externals are for inspiration and internals are for expiration. Right? They didn't name these muscles by the way that the air is moving. They named them by the layers where they are in your thorax, right? So the externals are the most superficial. Those are for inspiration. The internals are the deeper layer. Those are for expiration. All right, and some other muscles too. All of the stomach muscles are important for forced breathing. For instance, the rectus abdominis and then the internal, external, and obliques and the transverse abdominis, because when they contract, that's going to pressurize all your abdominal organs and force them up into the diaphragm, and then the diaphragm is going to push on the lungs to force air out of your lungs. All right, so those are important muscles for expiration. Oh, we talked about gas exchange already. All right, so what's an important consideration for exchange across the membrane? Okay, capillaries. It's got to have capillaries. Okay, and the epithelium should be nice, simple squamous. But what about the surface area or the size of the doorway? Right, so I want you to think of the size of the doorway. What's that doorway for exchange in the lungs? Half of a tennis court, basically, which is 70 square meters. That's a huge surface area. Okay. All right, control of respiration takes place mostly in the brainstem, in the medulla and the pons. There are respiratory centers there, right? And then, so there are chemoreceptors. There are some chemoreceptors in the medulla and the pons. There are also chemoreceptors in the arch of the aorta, and also in this junction, this bifurcation. Here's the common carotid, here's the internal and external carotid. Right at that bifurcation, there are carotid bodies that can measure chemical compositions of your blood. All right, now what did we call this area? It doesn't go very in much detail in your book, but I do want you to know what that bifurcation is called. There's kind of a swelling right there. The carotid bodies are those chemoreceptors, and there's some pressure receptors there as well, but that's called the carotid sinus. The carotid sinus is that bifurcation, and unfortunately, there's a lot of pathology and blood vessels in this area right here, and then it disrupts these chemoreceptors and pressure receptors, and that's the area that is, in a hospital, very busy all day long. People in ultrasound are taking pictures, ultrasounds, of that area to find vascular disease. It's a very common place for vascular disease. All right, so these aortic bodies and carotid bodies send information to the medulla. This is the respiratory center. Okay, in the medulla oblongata. All right, so what do we know about this? All right, the respiratory center controls the rate and depth of respiration. And you know what? I don't test people on this stuff anymore, the ventral group and the dorsal group. All right, so I think you can kind of cross these off your list. But you should know where the respiratory center is located. Where's that respiratory center located? In your notes, you should put the medulla and the pons. That's where these things are located right here. All right, so it's going to measure some chemicals, and if there's an imbalance in these chemicals, it's going to make a decision to maybe increase ventilation. All right, so it's going to send information to the diaphragm to contract. What's the name of the nerve that goes to the diaphragm?
Phrenic.
Yeah, the phrenic nerve. And you should know where it originates from. And where does it have to go through to get to the diaphragm? Remember C3, 4, and 5? Oh, maybe I didn't tell you this in lecture yet. But in lab, sorry, I'm flashing back to lab. C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. So that's how you can remember. C3, 4, and 5 is the origin for the phrenic nerve, right? So the phrenic nerve originates from the cervical plexus. Remember, so that nerve impulses can take alternate routes to get to the diaphragm because you can't live without using your diaphragm, right? Because you can't breathe. So it's a very important pathway. All right, so the inputs to the respiratory center. What do I want to tell you about this? Well, there are central receptors and peripheral receptors. The central receptors are in the medulla. The peripheral receptors are in the carotid sinus and the arch of the aorta. And they're most sensitive to, now what would you think? What should be controlling your respiration? What, think of a chemical compound. What would be good for your body to measure?
Oxygen.
That's what I always thought too, until I studied physiology. Perfect thing, because you need oxygen to stay alive, right? So it would be important. Well, our bodies don't work that way. There's actually a more important chemical compound, and when you take a physiology class, you'll understand why. It is carbon dioxide, which is the waste product of your respiratory processes. And when it starts to build up, it's going to drastically change the pH inside your body, which is even more dangerous, all right? And so these receptors are very sensitive to carbon dioxide. A small increase in carbon dioxide will cause a decrease in pH, which means your body is becoming more acidic, and that's going to be a very powerful stimulus to increase your breathing rate, or what we call ventilation. Okay. Now, if oxygen decreases dramatically, and I signified that by a lot of arrows right here, then that will have a very powerful effect on increasing your respiration, but oxygen has to drop tremendously before those chemoreceptors will sense that and send it to the medulla, right? So the most important chemical is CO2. There's some other things that can regulate ventilation, and that is the cerebral cortex. The diaphragm is skeletal muscle. It's under voluntary control, right? So higher centers, we just mean the cerebral cortex as opposed to the brainstem. And even emotional stimulus, right? Like if I were to walk by with a really sharp pencil and jab you in the side, right? You'd feel that pain. Guess what would happen to your respiratory rate? It would increase, right? Okay. All right. And voluntary means you can hold your breath or you can breathe forcefully if you want to, right? And we could all do this as an example, as voluntary control. We could all hold our breath, right? You want to try it? Let's all hold it for like 2 minutes. What's going to happen? That would be really cool. I call my boss, come down in 2 minutes. We hold our breath, and what's going to happen to all of us? We're all going to pass out. Clunk. And he walks in the room, and everybody's passed out. Would that be cool? That'd be pretty cool. We should try that sometime if I want to get back at him for anything. All right, but that's really such a big deal, because after we all pass out, what's going to happen? Those chemoreceptors are going to send information to the medulla saying your CO2 is way high and your oxygen is low, and the medulla is going to take over, and even though you're passed out, you're going to start breathing normally, right, to bring the CO2 down and oxygen back up. And I never did that as a little kid, but I hear little kids like to do that a lot to their parents to freak them out, right, if they get really mad. Oh, you used to do that when you were a little kid? No? Usually says, oh, my brother used to do that. And I go, yeah, right. Okay, so higher centers can control the respiratory center in the medulla. And a little experiment you could do right now, all right, you could, there are proprioceptors, right? Proprioceptors in muscles and all joints. And if you were to move a joint, like if I was going to exercise this biceps, what should I really do? I should get like a 100-pound weight, right, and curl the 100-pound weight. Now that biceps is really working, right? But if I'm just lifting my arm up and down, am I really exercising? Not really, right? I'm not working as hard as if I was lifting a 100-pound weight. But the proprioceptors in the joint are saying what? The joint is what, moving or not moving? It's moving. So if you were to move your legs and your arms, and you're not really exercising because you're sitting down, right, I know you're not exercising, but all that information is going to your brain. What does your brain start to think since you're moving? That you're exercising. So guess what? Even if you start to move a little bit like that, the brain thinks you're exercising. Guess what you're going to experience? You can do that right now. You're going to feel an urgency to breathe even though you're not really exercising. Okay, so that's the importance of proprioceptors in muscles and joints, right? To get more oxygen in your body, maybe even in preparation of exercise. All right, and then there's other receptors, like we said, touch, pain, and temperature. Temperature is a particularly efficient way of producing a gasp reflex. Okay, how could we, this would be a good experiment. I should have snuck in an ice cube in class, okay, and then walked around while I was lecturing and then put an ice cube on somebody's neck without them knowing. Guess what would happen? Well, yeah, hopefully, and then I'd have to run away really fast, but they would probably do what? They'd probably go, right? We call that a gasp reflex produced by that cold. All right, so that's another important reflex for controlling respiration. And around here, if you guys go out to the ocean on a boat, for instance, that's probably pretty important. Like if some people like to go fishing out on the ocean. What's the ocean like around here?
Dirty.
Well, it's sort of dirty. Not too dirty. Maybe if you're in the harbor or someplace. Yeah. But in terms of, what are we talking about? Temperature. It's cold. All right. So if you're fishing and all of a sudden a big wave comes by and knocks you off the boat, or you slip off the boat and fall into the ocean, it's going to be cold. And guess what you're going to do? It's just like putting an ice cube on you. You're going to go, okay? Now, why is that such a bad thing?
It's not bad.
Well, but what happens if we fall off a boat? Where's your head, maybe? Maybe underwater. If you're underwater doing, what are you breathing in? Not oxygen, but a bunch of water, right? Which then can cause you to drown as a result of that. And that gasp reflex is so fast and automatic, right? You maybe can't protect yourself from that. So that's kind of important to know about. Okay, gasp reflex due to temperature. All right, so that's pretty much the respiratory system. So what's the most important chemical in your body for controlling respiration? Carbon dioxide, not oxygen. Oxygen does if it gets really, really, really low. Okay? At the point of passing out, then oxygen will play an important role. Okay, and what's the structural and functional unit for exchange in the lungs? I want a little bit bigger package than just capillaries. What is that? What's that little berry, the little ball? Alveolus. The alveolus is that structural and functional unit for exchange. You should know what its shape is. If we add up the surface area of all of them, how big that surface area it is, what's around the alveolus that allows for exchange, the capillary, what allows air to move out of a capillary when we exhale, that's the elastic fibers, right? So have a nice picture of what that alveolus looks like. So that's where exchange takes place because of the special structures that are around it. All right, I'm going to load some other slides up for digestive system. I'm kind of lucky because you guys have all done digestive system in lab as well. Have you guys ever heard of hornblower yachts? Maybe some of you. Do you want to say these changes? Okay. Well, hornblower, it's a company. They have some boats in Newport Beach, and they have some boats in Marina Del Rey. And they're pretty big boats. You can rent them like if you're having a wedding or a Christmas party or something. And they take like maybe 30, 40, maybe even 70 people. That's a big boat through the harbor, you know, in the evening and have dinner on the boat, just kind of party a little bit with everything. And a couple of years ago, one of these boats in Marina Del Rey was out in the middle of the harbor and the engine caught on fire. Right, and it was pitch black because it was in December. It was a Christmas party, you know, and it gets dark around 4:30 or so, right? And so I read some accounts of this thing, and I was amazed that nobody died because they didn't have lifeboats. These things, because they never go out in the ocean, they just stay in the harbor. And in order to get people off the boat so they wouldn't burn to death when the boat caught on fire, they had them jump off the boat and swim over to a dock. And I go, well, how rude would that be? You're in an evening gown and, you know, a suit or something, and somebody said, okay, jump off the boat in the middle of the harbor, middle of the night. And nobody got hurt, nobody drowned, and I was just amazed because of what? What was that reflex that happens when you get cold? The gasp reflex. And I was really amazed to hear that. But since they didn't have lifeboats, guess what they probably did have? Life preservers. So they probably had everybody put on a life preserver before they jumped off the boat, but still, you can imagine what that would be like jumping off a boat, even with a life preserver, in the middle of the night. You probably wouldn't want to do that, unless what was happening? the boat was burning up around you, then of course you'd probably want to jump off. Okay. So, all right, so digestive system. Here we go for digestive system. All right, we don't need to look at this anymore. All right, all the components of the digestive system, from oral cavity down to anus. Well, we don't have some of these structures in here, but here are most of the tubes, right? You got oral cavity, and in the oral cavity you have some salivary glands that secrete saliva, and saliva has mucus in it. It also has an enzyme called salivary amylase that starts to break down sugars, but the mucus, right, is for lubrication, so a bolus of food doesn't get stuck in your esophagus on the way to the stomach. So you swallow through the pharynx into the esophagus and then into the stomach, and then these structures here help process so that you can absorb nutrition from the food that you eat. All right, so how much saliva do we make every day on a typical day for a typical person? Right here, 500 milliliters of saliva. And is that a lot of saliva? What is this right here? Here's 500 mLs right here. You make this much saliva every day. All right, and that's really gross if you think of like a baseball player, right? Baseball diamonds have got to be the dirtiest places on the planet. Okay. All right, so that's 500 mLs. Now, if that's in your oral cavity, which is really outside your body, so you're losing that much fluid from your body every day just by the production of saliva. That's a lot. That could dehydrate you. All right, so let's talk about layers of the digestive tract, because we're always interested in layers. All right, there are four main layers. The innermost layer is the mucosa. That's an epithelium. It's either stratified squamous, if it's like lining your mouth. Stratified squamous is specialized for surfaces that are being abraded or, right, because you're chewing food that scrapes off skin from the inside of your mouth, or a simple columnar epithelium. And that kind of epithelium, a simple columnar, is specialized for producing something and secreting it, all right, and also absorption. So secretion and absorption. All right, the lamina propria is connective tissue. There's some glands in there, some capillaries, right, and a little bit of muscle. And so that makes the mucosa. The next one is the submucosa. That's loose connective tissue, which has some arteries in it and veins and lymphatic vessels. And there is a nerve plexus that controls various muscles of the digestive tract. And then the next most superficial is the muscularis externa. Okay, these are the muscles that propel food through your digestive tract and then also break food up into various kinds of parcels. We're going to look at two different ways that these muscles work in just a little bit. And these muscles need to be coordinated, so there are more nerves, right, in this layer called, and we call this the myenteric plexus. So what's a plexus? It's a network of nerves, and it helps coordinate things, right? All right, so there are two important divisions of the autonomic nervous system. You can't control your digestive processes voluntarily. It's controlled automatically by the autonomic nervous system. And you know the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system, right? The parasympathetic and the sympathetic. Okay. Now, in the heart, parasympathetic decreases the heart rate. Sympathetic increases heart rate, but on the digestive system, it's the other way around. So the parasympathetic is what? Excitatory. It stimulates movements and secretions, and the sympathetic inhibits movements and secretions, right? So when you're in a fight or flight mode, that's not when you should be digesting food. That's when you should be using your muscles. When your heart is working, your brain is working, your eyes are dilated, right? When you're in a more resting mood, that's when you should be digesting things. And then the most superficial layer is the serosa. That's just a serous membrane that covers the muscularis. All right, so where are some of these layers at? Here's a pretty nice picture. You've got a good model in lab that shows these layers as well. All right, so here you see the serosa right here, right? And then the muscularis. muscularis region has these nerve plexes right here. And notice there are two layers. Here's a longitudinal layer of smooth muscle, and here's a circular layer of smooth muscle. The longitudinal is superficial, and the circular is deep. And then the submucosa, which contains glands and big blood vessels. All right, and then the mucosa. It has another muscle layer. It's got the lamina propria, and then it's got the endothelium right here, which is just an epithelium. And in most places of the digestive tract, these are going to be columnar cells. All right, so these are the different layers. And the digestive system has a tremendous number of nerve cells in the myenteric plexus for controlling motion of material through your GI tract. So what about your spinal cord? Do you think your spinal cord has a lot of neurons in it? Yeah, because that's pretty much all it is just neurons. But guess what? Your spinal cord doesn't have nearly as many neurons as your digestive tract does. Your digestive tract even has more neurons for controlling the digestive processes. And as a matter of fact, for years and years and years, people actually thought that the nerves of the digestive system were responsible for consciousness, and that's where you actually were thinking of things in your digestive tract, not in your brain and spinal cord, because it has many more neurons. All right, and sometimes people call that the myenteric nervous system. Right, but now we know it's just important for controlling digestive processes and not for taking a math exam or something like that. Okay, so those are the layers of the digestive tract. All right, the two kinds of motility are peristalsis and segmentation, two different ways. Peristalsis is for moving food antegrade, meaning from your mouth to your anus, one direction. Segmentation can be both antegrade and retrograde. That's a way of chopping a bolus of food up into smaller and smaller pieces and for mixing things together, because you want to mix the food that you eat with digestive juices to help digest the food into its basic building blocks so that you can absorb them. All right, so what does this look like? Okay, so here is, all right, the first kind of movement where you have smooth muscles contracting and forcing a bolus of food in one direction. What kind of motility is that? That's peristalsis, okay? But because of the myenteric plexus and the two different kinds of muscles, the circular and longitudinal muscles, all right, we can move food in this kind of direction where we have a bolus of food right here, and then this area of the wall is going to contract. So it's going to chop this bolus into two pieces, as well as this one over here. So then it's going to combine half of this compartment with half of this compartment to end up with this over here. All right, and then it's going to contract back over here. So this is going to mix this area up. So instead of moving food in one direction, what does it do? It just mixes all of these compartments together. And this is what we call segmentation. Right, this is for mixing the contents of your digestive tract together. Okay. All right, let me get started with the stomach. The function of the stomach is for storing and mixing. All right, what are some other functions of your digestive tract? When you eat something, it's a big complicated molecule. What do we call that process where you break it down into smaller molecules? Less complex. That is digestion. Notice, do I have digestion under stomach?
No.
It's not there. So stomach is not that important for digestion. Okay? One last thing. Another important thing is after things are digested into small molecules, you absorb them into your body, right, to feed the different cells of your body. What do we call that? That is absorption. I guess I said it in the definition. So do we see absorption as being an important function of the stomach? No. What were the important functions? Storing and mixing, but not necessarily digestion and absorption. That's going to take place with another part of the digestive system, all right, namely the small intestine. So I just want to point that out to you. All right, so next time, we're going to start here with stomach. You might want to review some of the gross anatomy of the stomach. for the next lecture. And so remind me, start here with stomach next time.